Continuing our study of Deuteronomy. It's on here, but not there, evidently. Thanks. So we are nearing the end of the book of Deuteronomy. We're supposed to finish it and getting into Joshua today in our reading. And the summaries for Joshua are already up on the site. I think I've made that live, but if not, they'll be live later. And so all this material will be available from this point forward. So let's take up in Deuteronomy very, very quickly. Don't want to review much. This is the giving of the law the second time, not a second law, but the same law repeated to a different generation 40 years after Sinai. And the distinctives is not just a different time in a slightly different place, 11 days journey from Sinai, but a whole different audience. A large part of the first audience had died in the wilderness as they wandered for 40 years because of their failure to enter the land of Canaan when God wanted them to. Saw that back in Numbers chapter 13. And we also noted that the law was expanded upon when you get into this statement of it in Deuteronomy, simply because the circumstances had changed. First giving of the law was given at Sinai, and most of the implementation of it concerning sacrifices and so forth was practiced in a very tight area in the Sinai, and as they were all grouped together, traveling in and around the tabernacle proper. Now they're going to be into the land, they're going to scatter all over the place, north, south, east, and west, and 2.5 tribes even remaining on the east side of the Jordan River. So the dynamic is going to change, and how the law is going to be expanded and carried out to fruition in that set of circumstances is going to be a little different. So when you get into the book of Deuteronomy, you're going to see some of those things enlarged and expanded upon. A lot of stuff that's in the book of Deuteronomy is repeat from what we saw in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. And so there's a huge dose of repetition, emphasis upon obedience to the law, emphasis upon worshiping as God wants Israel, emphasis upon the blessings that will come if they're obedient, and the withholding of blessings and the curses that will come if they're disobedient. And then it closes at the end with Moses' last speech, verses chapter 31 through 34. So we've gone through some of this. I'm going to go through it very, very quickly. Some of the things that we've seen before, miscellaneous regulations. Sometimes it's like the book of James or the book of Proverbs. In the book of Proverbs, it's like a different topic shows up every other verse. Sometimes in the opening chapters of the book of James, it moves very quickly, and James has often been compared to being a New Testament version of Proverbs because it has so many topics it introduced. A lot of that comes out in the very beginning of chapter 17. Everything with reference to what we saw before in Leviticus and Numbers, even at the end of Exodus, about proper sacrifice and not to be engaged in idolatry, that's repeated in this chapter as well. Chapter 17 talks about a future king that's going to reign. That's not going to come until the time of Saul. That's hundreds of years later. But each king was supposed to write out the law, the book of the law, mostly the book of Deuteronomy, in their own hands so that they would be guided by that. Chapter 18, more information about what Levi was to do. Remember, Levi was not numbered from the standpoint of tribal inheritance. They inherited cities scattered throughout the land, and so they were to be supported by the rest of the people, in part through the sacrificial system, but also through the donations that are going to be made to the tabernacle and then later to the temple. And so provision was made for them because God took them as a redemption price, so to speak, for the death of the firstborn, for the exemption of the death of the firstborn of man and beast in the land of Egypt. And so they became gods because of that. And so they become a type of the priesthood that we are today, that God has redeemed us and paid for us, and that we as priests in his kingdom are to be servants of his. Lots of distinctions are made in the 18th chapter about not getting involved in worship systems that are practiced in and around the nations, not just that they had observed in Egypt, but also in and around the nations, and those are very significant. We'll see in 15 and following, there's an emphasis upon a singular prophet, often referred to as the prophet, that's going to come. That's fulfilled in Jesus. Acts twice at least talks about that. In the book of Hebrews is all about that. And so Moses is talking about a continuation of what starts in him that's going to continue through a long line of prophets, ultimately fulfilled in Christ. More about that as we get into the chapter. The cities of refuge, these are places that were set up as a means of judgment systems. That if people were accused of some crime, falsely or legitimately, that they were trial courts that were set up in these cities of refuge, and that there were protocol to follow to determine whether or not somebody was innocent or guilty, and how judgment was going to be meted out. Those details are all spelled out in chapter 19. We left off last time in chapter 20, noticing rules about wars. And this is not necessarily rules about engagement of wars, but who could and could not go to war based upon age, based upon marriage, based upon other circumstances, and so forth. And so that's spelled out in detail. What is to be done upon the defeat of another nation, how they're going to treat those people, and what they're going to do with what is captured from them, from the standpoint of not only persons but also things, and how those things were supposed to be dedicated to God, generally speaking. So that's brought out in this context. A lot of the rules of engagement that they're going to fulfill when they actually come into the land of Canaan during the period of conquest that starts in the next book, the book of Joshua. Chapter 21. Unknown murders and the roles of the elders. This is rules concerning the cities of refuge. Somebody is slain and nobody knows who's slain. And so, you know, this is not crime scene investigation like you see on television or movies or whatever today. A city where a crime has been committed doesn't want to, you know, look as if God's withholding blessings because some crime's been committed and nobody knows who it's done. And that looks bad for them. So the guilt of the innocent, blood from among them was to be put away by going through the process that's spelled out here. And again, that's in connection with what we saw a couple chapters before about the cities of refuge. Who you could and could not marry. This is going to be a big thing as you get into the next few chapters, chapter 24 and following. God did not, generally speaking, want the children of Israel to marry anybody else who wasn't like them. And that doesn't mean that there weren't good people that existed out there in the rest of the world that weren't Jews. Just a reminder, when we get into the book of Ruth, Naomi and her husband and her two sons left the land of Bethlehem, the house of bread, which it literally means, and they went into the land of Moab. And generally speaking, the Moabites were arch rivals of the children of Israel. But each of her two sons married Moabite women. And so both of the sons died, the husband died. Ruth and the other daughter-in-law were going to come back. And she said, no, you stay. And one daughter remained. But Ruth said, no, I'm going to go wherever you go. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to follow your God. So Ruth was a Moabitess. There were rules about how you could and could not marry people from other nations. Part of those protocols are spelled out here. Also concerning rules about what happens if you capture a nation and wives and women from who are captured or whose husbands died. Could you or could you not marry? All those rules are given here. There are also rules, and I want to mention this, and this is going to get more tricky as we go further. There are rules about how women who are the not the first or the ordinal wife, the second, third, whatever wives down the line, how they were to be treated. And this is a very awkward thing to discuss from the standpoint of our perspective, because there's an emphasis in the context of the New Testament about, for example, an elder or a deacon being the husband of one wife, not multiple wives. And so there were some things that God overlooked and allowed under the age of patriarchy that are kind of troublesome. Let me simply say, that wasn't God's initial intent. And you go back and you read in the book of Genesis in the fourth chapter, Lamech simply says he had two wives. Doesn't say good, doesn't say bad, just notice that. But that's a change in the genealogical record there. And those people who had been reading that the first time during the time of Moses would have noticed that God called attention. This guy did something that not anybody else had done before. And in the rest of the genealogy, you don't see it again until later. And so it became a commonplace practice for people to have multiple wives. Well, why? Why did God allow that? Well, that's an incredible question, and we could spend a lot of time discussing that. Lots of books and lots of lectures and essays have been written about it. But there are some things that God allowed until the revelation of God was complete. One of the things that's brought out in the context of the book of Deuteronomy going forward is God tried to regulate abuses. What does that mean? He didn't stop them immediately, but he regulated them, and over time, those are going to come to an end. Same issue is brought out with reference to slavery. Slavery was allowed in the context of the Old Testament, but it was a different kind of slavery. It didn't start necessarily as a racial, prejudicial, biased thing, assumption of a condescending race over an inferior race, which is a lot of what happened with reference to African-American slavery that's, we are familiar with, and I say we in a larger scale for the last 400 plus years. That's not what was involved in this. A lot of it was due to defeat by another nation or due to economic needs. People could literally sell themselves. And so we may not hear much about it today, but it's still practiced in some places where people are thrown into debtor's prison. And so they become enslaved because of indebtedness, not because of racial orientation or anything else like that, or because they were defeated by another nation. My point is, all of those complex laws are addressed in part in the book of Deuteronomy. I say in part because we're going to see more of that spelled out later. And God has regulations about how you can do that. And so part of the issue was, once people start having one wife, two wives, three wives, second, third wives, and whatever, weren't always treated like the first one. And so does that become an issue of tension in the context of the Old Testament? It does. So part of the assumption was that if a woman had a handmaid and she was not able to have a child, that her husband could bear children by her handmaid, and it would be considered hers. You might think, that's crazy. All right, but that's an Abraham thing. Abraham had a child by Sarah, by Sarah's handmaid, and Sarah's handmaid wasn't Sarah, but the child was going to be considered hers. But immediately she saw that there was tension that developed between her handmaid and Sarah, and so she asked Abraham to send her and the child away. That's going to be an issue later with reference to the birth of Samuel, and Hannah was not the favorite wife. It's going to be an issue with reference to Jacob. And the sons and daughter that he had, he has by two different wives and two different handmaids, so a total of four. And there's lots of tension that's spelled out there in Genesis chapter 34 and following. So in this context, there are rules about how you treat other people. Now you might say, well, if he would just outlaw all of this all at once, that would solve a problem. Well, they still need to be cared for even after the mistakes that were made. And so there are lots of unique situations about this that will be discussed as you go throughout the rest of the text. What to do if a child is overly rebellious? Rules are given about how bodies of slain individuals are to be handled. This is not just a protocol respect sort of thing. After Saul was killed and his sons, they nailed their bodies to the wall of the Philistine cities. And David sent an entourage of people there to rescue their bodies so that they would receive a proper burial. So it was a medicinal thing from the standpoint of how bodies were handled, but it was also an ethical thing about respect for those who had died. All right, chapter 22 talks about responsibility with reference to your possessions and a neighbor's possessions. What's the point? You don't borrow everything from your neighbors and never return it, and so forth. And about if you lose something or break something, you may be financially responsible for that. So that's brought out in this context. Chapter 22 also talks about the uniqueness of dress that distinguishes between men and women. Years ago, and even to some extent now, a lot of people wear clothes that are described as unisex. And you might say, well, what does that mean? Well, there's some moral, sexual overtones involved in that. But then there's some things that are practical. I mean, doctors and nurses all wear scrubs. You know, they don't all wear the same colors, but some of it's kind of standardized. In the Old Testament, lots of people wore robes and so forth. And so, you know, there wasn't a male robe department in the department store and a female robe department in the department store. They didn't have that. But there was a lot of similarity in dress. The prohibitions that are mentioned in this context are not saying don't wear anything that looks like a man might wear it, or don't look anything, wear anything like that looks like a woman might wear it, but assume that there's a gender identity, that's a huge term in the context of what we deal with today, that's consistent. Men aren't supposed to be women, women aren't supposed to be men. And so it's the issue of parading oneself as something else other than that. I have never watched this show. And I only know of its name because I see it. But the whole RuPaul drag queen thing, if you've ever seen that, I had no idea. I heard him interviewed the other day. That show's been on television for 12 years. All right? There's a good sense in things on television that you don't have to watch because you don't have one. And I was totally unaware of that. But the whole thing is a contest in which men masquerade as women by wearing absolutely outrageous, flamboyant, over-the-top, glamorous makeup. And I only know that because I heard part of an interview with this gentleman as I was driving down the road the other day. That's the thing that's brought out in this context. Don't pretend to be something that you're not in lots of different ways, but in this context, sexually. So that's an issue that's presented here, and that's addressed at length. And so it does not mean that it's not an issue of wearing somebody else's clothes. It's an issue of assuming an identity that's not yours, all right? Lots of things go on in the context of local news, national news, international news, that addresses these things. Well, in the context of the Old Testament, these things were addressed. All right, regulations that were spelled out before near the end of the chapter, verses 6 through 12, about wildlife, housing, sewing, plowing, garments, fringes, all of these are issues of distinctiveness and holiness in which God wanted Israel to be identified as being uniquely His. They were badges, so to speak. They were identifiers, signals that they were willing to submit to God. And so some of those things might seem to be odd to us, but it's a means of identification. All right, this is not saying that they're all totally parallel, but we do that on a regular basis. I have all of the ribbons that my dad had when he was in the service for 32 years. And so I've identified all of them. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but he had a ribbon bar that looked like it was about 6 inches high and 5 inches wide. And each one of those not only had medals associated with it, but those were the short ribbon. They all stood for something. They identified one's connection with something. Service at this time, at this place, you know, humanitarian service at this war, that, you know, occupation, whatever it might have been. They all identified who he was in connection to his time in service in both the Army, Army Air Corps, and then, of course, in the Air Force. So there's an identification thing. And so all of those things are identifying person as uniquely connected to this, right? This branch of the service or this job or this whatever of this academic institution. God did things similar to that in order to have his people identify as his. So they were badges, they were ribbons, they were indicators, they were identifiers that they were willing to subscribe to who God was. So that was a very, very big thing for God expecting his people to respect all of these things. Chapter 23, and who could and could not be identified as members of the congregation. So this is interesting as you go through the book of Exodus and you talk about the construction of the tabernacle. It talks about the entire nation of Israel gathering together at the door of the tabernacle and assembling as one congregation sometimes. And in the New Testament, you see the Old Testament Israel referred to as the church in the wilderness. What's the point? They were not just a traveling group of people. They weren't just a camping group of people. They weren't just a worshiping group of people. They were an assembling group of people. And so all of those are identifiers as to who they were and what they were doing. And so this notion of assembling and who could be included and who could not be included is addressed. That's going to come into play later during the period of the Restoration, when Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah are reestablishing the system that God wanted set up initially during the time of Moses, reestablishing it as they're coming back, and some of the people who weren't Jews wanted to be part of what's going on. Tobiah, Sanballat, and so forth. We find out that there was some intermarriage between some of the Samaritans and some of the priests, and that some of the Samaritans were actually living in quarters in the temple. And when the leaders found out about it, said, no, that's not what we're about. We're not about compromising what God wants us to do. And so some of those Samaritans made a claim, and this is interesting. They said, we've been worshiping God as long as you've been worshiping God. Well, the legitimacy of that claim might be considered, but even if it were true, it's not the length of time that they were worshiping, it's the issue of how. When Jesus spoke to the woman at the well, John chapter 4, she says, our fathers worshiped God at this mountain. And she was referring to Mount Gerizim, which was probably within sight of where she was standing, or Jesus was standing, or both of them were. And the temple had been destroyed there during the time of the Maccabeans, about 100 years prior to the time that they were speaking, the ruins of which might have still been visible. But her point was, our ancestors have been doing this for a long time at this place. And so it's not an issue of how long, but it's an issue of how long and what you are doing and how you are doing it. And so that's going to come into play about worship and what nations could be included or not included and so forth. Issues about sanitation, and again, more often than those are not just medicinal, those are not just health related, those are holiness related and practically related as well. Notice also, and again, there's a hodgepodge of things that are addressed here, verses 15 and following. Rules about servants, sexual perversions, and their details spelled out there. Lending of money, vows, and hospitality. You might say, well, that's just everything at once. That's my point. But these are summations of things that had been introduced prior. So we're not, expanding upon them. But chapter 24 is another chapter. We noticed this before, back in chapter 22, if I'm not mistaken. Chapter 22, verses 15 and following, talks about rules that govern multiplicity of wives. Chapter 24 is a very, very big section because it deals with the issue of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Let me just simply say this. That's 1,500 years on the other side of Jesus, and we're 2,000 years on this side of Jesus. So 3.5 millennia ago, 3,500 years ago, the issue of marriage and who could marry, and divorce and who could divorce, and remarriage and who could remarry, hasn't gone away in 3,500 years. And it was an issue even before that, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 4. And so part of the issue that's addressed in this context is men assuming, and this was a huge debate during the time of Jesus in Matthew 19, assuming that you could put away a woman for just whatever reason. And so they were doing so for the slightest of reasons. And so there's a philosophical religious difference in the major schools of thought during the time of Jesus, where people say it could be had to be a substantive reason. She had to fail in some moral way. And other people said, no, she could just fail in any way. And so God, through Moses, legislated a control factor. Right? Please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. There are some places in the country that have set up safe houses providing needles for people who want to use drugs. You might think, well, that's about the dumbest thing I ever heard of. Well, people who are drug addicts, they're going to take drugs, and they're going to use whatever they can. All right? And so some people, in order to limit or restrict the damage done by people that are just going to go out and use drugs all the time, say, if you're going to do that, let us at least give you things that aren't going to infect you. You might say, wouldn't it just be better to just stop them all, throw them all in jail? Well, that's a solution of one kind. But it's a restrictive solution in order to keep people from killing themselves. Now, I've got it. Some people might say, those people deserve to die. I understand that mindset. I don't agree with that mindset. Those are souls that are trapped in horrible situations that need physical salvation, but they also need spiritual salvation. And so doing something to restrict their behavior that could kill them might be considered to be politically correct or incorrect, depending on where you're standing. But the point is, it was an attempt to control something that was out of hand. This is an attempt to control something that was out of hand. And so God's restrictive measures in this context were intended to be for the benefit of women and benefit of marriage, generally speaking. Now, that's going to come into play in just a second, as we're going to say in Matthew chapter 19. Mr. George.
This is current events.
That's correct.
And the state of Utah and their legislature are still talking about polygamy today. And
that's correct.
It's just in the recent current news.
That's correct.
That they're meeting and talking about polygamy because they obviously have a reason of why they want to do it. And if you in Holland, or if you go to Amsterdam, you could smoke dope in a cafe, and they did a needle exchange and free needles to these people. And I've seen pictures of the parks. They briefed us on it. And you can't go into the parks because they're literally covered with used needles. Because a drug addict, he don't care.
He
doesn't care if they're trying to help him stay clean. He's going to be dirty anyway.
Yeah. Part of the reason why they adopt laws like this is try to limit the damage people can do to themselves. All right. So if you've been reading anything at all, you'll see about everything that's going on all around the world, about attempts to contain, to isolate, quarantine, and so forth, what's going on in the light of the coronavirus. Well, I read something to Evelyn. I said, tell me if you notice anything different in this. And it talked about the extreme measures that people were taking. In France, saying they're closing down the cinema, which is what we refer to as the movie theaters and so forth, and restaurants and cafes and bars and that sort of thing. And Spain's doing the same thing, and Germany's doing the same thing. And I read Evelyn the list of things that were being shut down in Germany. So I went through the list, and the last thing in the list was brothels. Brothels. You might think, what do you mean? They ought to be shut down anyway. No, it's totally legal.
It's legal in Germany.
It's legislated, yeah. And they collect taxes. And in order to serve as a prostitute in a place like that, you have to be licensed, you have to be registered, and you have to be tested. You might think, this is insane, all right? From the standpoint of our perspective morality, you might think, just shut it down. Their point is, people are going to go to prostitutes, or whatever else you might want to refer to them as, anyway. And so what they did was they legalized it so it could be controlled. Why are they trying to control it? You might say, well, they're trying to get money out of it. The main reason initially was to prevent the spread of disease. And so you can't engage in business as a prostitute if they find out you're infected with something. And so you might think, well, that's a very strange way of going about controlling something. My point is, it was an issue to control and restrict, but not to stop. And so there's a sense in which that's going on in this context. Now, let me jump forward to Matthew 19. The religious leaders came to Jesus challenging him about marriage and divorce and said, this is what Moses allowed. And Jesus said, that's true, that's what Moses allowed. But watch what he said. Moses allowed this only because of the hardness of your heart. What's the point? Something was wrong with what you were doing. There was a heart attitude, there was a practical attitude, there was a disregard for other souls, in this context women. And God restricted this in order to control what was an abuse. And so there's a restrictive aspect of it, not a total wipeout of it. But then Jesus did something. He says, but from the beginning it was not so. Even what Moses allowed was not what God intended. You might say, but Moses was a representative of God. Well, Moses only did what God told him to do. Moses didn't make up the law. So it's a God-originating restrictive practice. And that's important for us to understand today. Now,
Nehemiah, Ezra read the law. The slate was wiped clean.
That's correct.
Done away with then.
And so, and we're going to see this. The issue of how we treat others, neighbors, love your neighbor. All right. Let me just simply say, the love your neighbor principle doesn't mean love your next door neighbor. Doesn't mean love your person that works with you. Love the person that you went to school with, or the person that's a current schoolmate. It means love everybody who's not you. That includes loving your wife. And so there's no explicit Ten Commandment that says love your wife if you're a husband, love your husband if you're a wife. That all comes under the rubric of love your neighbor. Love everybody that's not you. So the way men were treating their wives, husbands were treating their wives, was not a love your neighbor thing. And so Jesus corrects that in part. God corrects that through Moses in part through what's going to happen here. What's interesting in the dynamic in which you see in the New Testament, Jesus talks about the stringent nature of what God required. In Matthew and in Mark, twice in Matthew and in Mark, he not only talks about physical immorality, he talks about spiritual immorality. He talks about looking at somebody to desire something that's not yours with reference to physical connection relationship. He said, you've already committed sin in your own heart. And so Jesus said, this is part of God's intent. You know, the book of Proverbs is filled with lots of innuendo, and I don't mean anything negative about that, about women being respected by their husbands, all right? And so there are lots of indirect references that are used euphemisms, and it says, drink from your own well. Well, that's not just talking about get water from your own tap or water from your own well. It means be satisfied with your own wife. The book of Malachi deals with the same thing later and talks about loving the wife of your youth. So there's a huge issue of respect that's supposed to be brought out in the context of marriage. That does not mean God wasn't concerned about abuses. Now let me simply say something else that's important here in this context. What's brought up in Deuteronomy chapter 24 shows up again in the New Testament, and it's still an issue today. What God intended for marriage was not a Jewish thing. You might say, well, it's right here in the book of the law, Deuteronomy 24. Let me just remind you, in Genesis, there were no Jews. Adam and Eve weren't Jews. Adam and Eve weren't members of any country. They weren't part of a nation. There was no Israel. There was no Judah. There was no Canaan. There was no land of Palestine. There was no nothing. There were no nations. And so they were individuals created in the image of God. And the principles that God put into place with reference to marriage were intended to be universal to all humanity, regardless of what they were religiously, ethnically, or from what country they came from. And that's a principle that's bound everywhere in the New Testament, and it hasn't gone away today. John the Baptizer, John the Baptist as we often call him, lost his head, not through his own choosing, because he stuck his nose into the marital affairs of Herod. This is not Herod the Great, this is one of his sons. Why? Because he took another brother's wife. He says, it's not lawful for you to have her. What's interesting is, it was lawful according to the laws of the land for him to have more than one wife. So he wasn't doing anything illegal from the standpoint of what would have been allowed during Roman law of the day. So what was he violating? He was violating a law that was transcendent, greater than in time and in place, of the laws of the day. What was that? God's law with reference to marriage. So the principles of marriage and divorce and remarriage don't apply just in the context of Judaism, restricted here in Deuteronomy 24, but go all the way back to the beginning. It's exactly what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19. These principles apply to everybody, everywhere. Now that's a huge debate when you get in the context of dealing with spiritual things today. People will say, well, all those things that they did before becoming Christians. If you kill somebody before you become a Christian, that's murder. If you kill somebody after you become a Christian, that's murder. If you cheat on your wife before you become a Christian, that's adultery. If you cheat on your wife after you become a Christian, it's adultery. Before or after becoming a member of the body of Christ doesn't make sin any worse or any less, depending on when it happened. And so the principle has always been the case. And so that's troublesome in the context of dealing with things in our world today. And let me just mention this, that Herod the Great had at least 10 wives at one time, divorcing as many as 3 in the context of one calendar year, and even killing them when he thought they were challenging him. Why would I bring that up? Herod was an Idumean, that is a descendant of Edom, but his family had converted by proselytization to Judaism at some point. And so you see intermarriage between the Maccabeans, some of whom were Jewish priests, and the Idumeans, vice versa, in their different seed lines. My point is, the Herod that was told you're not supposed to have her may have been assuming some connection with Judaism, or may have not been involved in it any more than his ancestors prior before that just claimed to be connected to God's law. At any point, what he did was wrong. And John called him on it. So God controls this in the context of the book of Deuteronomy 24. Now George already alluded to what we're going to read when we get into the time of Zerubbabel and Nehemiah and Ezra, because that's going to come up again. Because in order to establish the priesthood and its purity, men were not allowed to continue to have wives that they weren't initially married to or should not have been married to at all. So that's just one time it's going to come up in Malachi as well. The whole notion of God comparing Israel to his bride indicates that the bride was supposed to be pure, spiritually speaking, and also physically speaking in this context. So, the rest of chapter 24, rules about pledges. Those are vows that you make. Those are promises to make payments or to do something that you had vowed to do. Pledges and vows are sometimes connected. And last part talks about, notice, treatment of others. This is a neighbor thing, servants, penalty for sin, and hospitality. That's an interesting thing. Just a reminder. From this point forward, when they were in the land and they conquered the land, God expected them to treat everybody else better than the way they were treated when they were in the land of Egypt. How were they treated in the land of Egypt? They were enslaved. They were beaten. They were abused. They were taken advantage of. He says, when you come into your land, you don't do that. Don't be like the Egyptians were to you. Be better than that to others. Now that's a principle of love your neighbor that's brought out in the Old Testament, but it's also what we see brought out in the New Testament. Loving your neighbor is a fulfillment of the law and the prophets. That's everywhere in the Gospels. That's also in the book of James and elsewhere. All right, chapter 25, about concerning judgment and how punishment is to be meted out. This is to be taken in concert with the laws about the cities of refuge and the process of judgment before. The principles of levirate marriage, which is talking about maintaining seed lines for brothers who died or killed in war and so forth. That was a seed line thing, not a sexually oriented thing. What it meant to be honest in business, you're going to see this everywhere in the prophets, warning people about using false systems of weights and measures to take advantage of others. Don't do that. One of my favorite Norman Rockwell paintings was the one in which the lady's in the butcher shop and she's buying some cut of meat or whatever, and the butcher has his thumb on the scale pushing it down, and she can't see him doing that, But he can't see what she's doing. She's got her hands on the bottom pushing it up. And so they're both counteracting each other. She's trying to take advantage of him. He's trying to take advantage of her. And Norman Rockwell countered that in his inimitable way. Well, don't do that. Don't try to take advantage of somebody. Don't get something that's not on sale and steal a price sticker from something that else is on sale and put it on there. Let me just tell you, there's cameras everywhere. You could get caught doing that. But at the same token, don't be a business person who says, well, the regular price on this is X, and you mark it down 50%, you pull off all the stickers, you see it was never near X. So my point is, don't cheat somebody if you're a customer, but don't cheat somebody if you're a business owner. The whole point about being honest in business. All right, last few verses of the chapter talk about defeating Amalekite and remembering what they did to the children of Israel as they were coming through the land of wilderness and as they were to fight against them. That's going to show up even as far down the road as we see in the context of Saul's kingdom. Chapter 26 is all about tithing, and we've addressed that before in First Fruits. And we're not going to mention that again. Chapter 27 talks about the stones that they're to erect when they come into the land of Canaan as a reminder of the laws that God gave them. They erect 10 stones, one for each of the commandments that's initially given. And we see when the children of Israel cross over the Jordan and come into the Jordan that that's what they did. Jeff, I owe you an apology. You had your hand up some time ago, and I forgot to let you speak, and that's my bad. I just look at you and said, you're very patient. I apologize. I owe you an apology.
No problem. No, I was just going to ask, when God gave the commandment about an eye for an eye, I was just wondering, wasn't that kind of based on the same logic, if you want to call it that, the same principle as about the exception that God gave Moses for divorcement?
Yeah, now that's an interesting principle. And when we get into the New Testament, we're going to talk about that. Jesus would say, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and that sort of thing. But then he would say, you know, I said, turn the other cheek. And so the woman that's taken in adultery in that part of the text, that part of John 7 into John chapter 8, if that was the case, she could have been killed. But Jesus said, go and sin no more. After he has spoken to those who were there. Now that's a disputed section of the text from the standpoint of its legitimacy, but the principle is consistent with who Jesus was. And so we're going to see that the New Testament demonstrates a higher level of grace and mercy in its particulars, but not in its principles. And so I want to talk about that when we get there, but thank you for bringing that up. All right, notice when they come into the land, they're going to see two mountains. Going to see Mount Gerizim, and they're going to see Mount Ebal. Mount Gerizim is representative of the blessings, and Mount Ebal, the withholding of the blessings and the curses. And so God says it's as obvious as these two mountains are. And so he says, choose this day, you know, whom you're going to serve. That's what Joshua says, but this is the same thing. Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse, Deuteronomy 11. And so it's as obvious as these two mountains are. And so God says, this is what you need to think about. If you are not faithful, that mountain stands before you to represent all the things that are going to be withheld from you if you're not faithful. Chapter 28, first four verses, obedience that comes from, blessings from obedience, cursings that come from disobedience, that whole chapter is on and on and on and on. If you do blah, 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 then this is going to happen. If you do bad, this is the consequence. If you do da-da-da-da good, then this is the consequence. Repeated over and over and over. So that principle is all over the book of Deuteronomy, especially chapter 28 and following. Chapter 29, we'll stop after this, take up with 30 and finish that and get into Joshua this evening. First nine verses from another admonition to be, form another admonition to be obedient to the will of God. Trust and obey, trust and obey. And we sing that song and we may have lost the significance of meanings. Trust is faith. But it's not just faith, it's trust in the promises of God as an element of faith. And so your faith doesn't save you unless your faith is connected to who God is. It's a trust in God's character. When you go into and out of the water in baptism, it's not your faith that makes your sins go away. You say, well, I believe it happens. Well, I'm not saying that's wrong. It's a right belief. But your belief doesn't make your sins go away. It's trust in God's promise and God's power that makes your sins go away. So you have trust in God's power because God is the power to save. And so in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 5, it says, we are kept guarded, in some terms, surrounded, protected. We are kept by the power of God through faith. And I mentioned this many times, but I want to mention again, faith is always a point of access. That's a doorway. That doorway allows you access into something else. The doorway is not the most important thing. It's an access to what's most important. And that's the way faith is used in the New Testament. It's a doorway into something greater. What's it a doorway into? It's a doorway into God's grace. Why is it a doorway into God's grace? Because that's what the text says, Romans chapter 5. In the New Testament, when that use of doorway, prosago, which means a way into, is used with reference to spiritual things, it always moves from a lesser place to a greater place. The doorway isn't the house. The doorway isn't the room on the other side of it. It's a way to get there. And so God's grace is on the other side of the doorway of faith. And so in this context, it talks about the significance of trusting in God. That's our faith in God's promises, that we trust God's going to do what he said he's going to do. God says, when you do what I ask you to do, I will do what I promised to do for you. That's what happens in the context of all obedience. That's what happens in the context of our baptism into Christ. All right, verse 5, notice God reminds them, this is what I've done for you for 40 years. Clothes haven't worn out. Food has been provided every day. I haven't had any diseases. So he's reminding them that you have already been blessed in a way that I will continue to bless you in a different way when they come into the land of Canaan. And then again, ends with a warning against disobedience. All right, so we'll finish the last few chapters and start into Joshua, where we start in our reading today, this evening, with chapter 30. All right.